Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, when the store is quiet, I get to chat to my friends about the films and the series that we're loving. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV?
How's it?
Good morning.
Hello.
How are you guys doing?
Fine.
Yeah, all right. Thank you.
Are you strong?
Yeah, I'm pretty strong.
Yeah, very strong.
Good. We've got ourselves a Kolski.
Hey.
Who is a digital copywriter.
Yeah.
We're not working here at the video store. We've got ourselves a P-Dog.
Hello.
I don't know. I tried something new.
It's good. No, I appreciate it.
I call the musicians like, actually.
It's a major third.
Yeah, you need to bring it down.
All right. We've got ourselves a Perrin, who is a, writer, director, camera person, everything. We're not working here.
Plumber, roof man, whatever you need.
My name is Russell. I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. And every now and again, we get behind this counter. We work our shift here at the video store. So thank you for wandering in to our lovely video store. We've got lots of movies and series here on the shelves. And hopefully we can figure out something for you guys to watch. And also just be informed on what's happening in this world.
Yeah.
Because sometimes life imitates art and art imitates life.
Mm. That's right.
We are witnessing the decline of the American
Empire,
yeah. As Perrin puts it, and we are watching season one of The Handmaid's Tale slowly come closer and closer.
Yeah. Hickeys.
Yeah, scary.
We will talk about that and many things. I want to talk about Snow White, which is a movie not for gentlemen in their 30s, but still something for gentlemen in their 30s to
get angry about.
Just chat about in general, because I think there were lots of rumblings, as the world knows. I don't think we really even know what we were rumbling about half the time.
Yeah.
But
DEI.
Yeah. No. But out this movie comes, and I'm here to tell you that it's pretty traditional, pretty harmless, and pretty charming.
Okay.
So we'll get into that. I want to talk a little bit about just the first one in general, because I think we haven't watched it, and we don't really talk much about the 1937 Snow White.
Yeah,
right.
And I think there's some interesting stuff to talk about with that. There's some great television.
There is great television, dude.
We're in the middle of
the golden age.
But White Lotus, Severance, a whole bunch of stuff. Okay, is that what you're watching?
What are you watching?
The Wheel of Time.
Sick, yeah.
I don't even know what that is.
Okay, we'll talk about it.
Okay, lovely. Okay, but we tend to start these days with a little, hey, did you guys see? So it's our quick little news flash roundtable. Mm-hmm. Does anyone want to kick this one off?
Not me. I haven't been watching.
Okay, P-Dog.
Yeah. Okay, I hate teasers for trailers. Like,
you got to say the line.
Oh. Sorry. Hey, did you guys see the teaser for the trailer for the new Paul Thomas Anderson film came out? And I'm fucking pumped for that.
So now
you like teasers?
No. I mean, the proper trailer is coming up this week.
Okay.
But yeah,
I've seen this in the schedule. So as a cinema owner, I'm privy to a release schedule where for months, even into next year, I'm seeing when these films are like dated to release, because they often just put a little flag in the sand so that everybody knows, okay, stay away from the, and often untitled. So it'll be like untitled Universal film.
Yeah,
and then everyone goes like, oh, fuck, that might be a big dinosaur movie. Yes. Let's stay away from that and release on another day.
Yeah.
But I've seen untitled Paul Thomas Anderson
film. We have a title now.
What is the title?
One Battle After Another. One Battle After Another.
Okay.
And what, do we know what it's about?
Not really. I mean, it's based on a Robert Pynchon novel. But all we know is from what we saw is that like Leo DiCaprio is teaching his daughter how to shoot or something.
Okay.
But it's like a weird, it's a cool little teaser because it's like a pregnant woman with a machine gun shooting, and then it cuts to like, I'm assuming his daughter later on shooting and stuff like that. And he's like this weird, like, beardy man with a gun, rifle and stuff like that. I don't really know what
kind
the
of time, what kind of time period are we in?
I think it's contemporary. Because it'll be his first. It'll be his first contemporary film since Punch Drunk. Now,
okay, can you give me a quick rehash on Paul Thomas Anderson? Because I often get him confused with
Resident Evil guy.
Well, I get him confused with
the better Paul Thomas. Yeah,
no,
yeah,
with the dude who made Sideways and Holdovers,
Alexander Payne.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Alexander Payne and Paul Thomas Anderson somehow are confuddled in my brain.
PTA is literally in my top three favorite filmmakers of all time.
The big ones being
There Will Be Blood, Magnolia, Boogie Nights,
yes,
Punch Drunk Love, The Master.
Yes.
Phantom Thread, which is fucking amazing, and it's so underrated.
Okay.
Inherent Vice gets better with each viewing.
Oh, Inherent Vice. I love that movie.
Myself and Cole watched that in lockdown. It was one of our like nerdy cinema films.
When he looks at that photo of like...
I definitely need another watch there.
And he just gives it back.
My favorite's Josh Brolin just eating a handful of weed and just like eating it.
When he's eating the lollipop in the car and Thomas Anderson's just... Phoenix is just watching him and he's like, oh, it's so good.
I didn't enjoy that one. So I think I need more viewings.
It gets better with each viewing. First time I watched it, I didn't know how to feel. I was conflicted. Every time I've watched it after, it's fucking great. It's great like paranoia, LA... stoner noir. It's great.
It's such a niche genre. Yeah.
I had the benefit of a literature student breaking down the novel for me and talking about how it's about like urban expansion, but then the period at the end of the free love movements in America and how that's kind of being stifled by conservative values and it's like being killed.
Yeah,
that's interesting. This is Inherent Vice. Mm.
Yeah, if you want to see Martin Short as a coked up dentist,
yes,
that's your movie, man.
Because Boogie Nights was also this lovely change in society as that kind of porn era comes to an end and it's just getting a bit more icky. I think it was the sort of start of HIV in the 90s and the sort of, interesting.
Yeah, that's, I mean, PTA, his most common themes throughout, I mean, it changed for a brief period after, like, between The Master and now. But like a lot of his movies, his themes often involved dysfunctional family. If you look at all of his movies, there's always some sort of family element about dysfunctionality. You know what I mean?
Has he ever won an Oscar?
No, he should have won for There Will Be Blood. He should have won Best Director for that.
And also Phantom Thread was very nominated at its time, right?
Yeah, one of the biggest, The Master. So The Master is my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie. That's got all the nominations for acting, but somehow didn't get a nomination for directing or writing. Like that is weird to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because the director directs that acting.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
It's not always the performance.
Yeah. Yes. So he should have won for There Will Be Blood.
You craft
that was a strong year. Fuck me.
You craft that performance out of the actor as the director.
You also edit it.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Hey, did you guys see what the Bioscope is screening on Easter Sunday?
Is it The Passion of the Christ?
Life of Brian.
Oh, that's cool.
And I was like, how in 15 years of the Bioscope
have you never done that?
Have we never done The Life of Brian as the classic movie Sunday on Easter Sunday?
I love that.
It was like, this is either the best idea or like the most insensitive idea I've ever had.
Exactly.
But what I love about it is that it isn't Brian isn't Jesus. He's just Jesus's neighbor.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, the classic Monty Python film is all set around the time of Jesus where a very innocent, very normal guy called Brian is mistaken for Jesus. And it's delightful and it's funny and it's timeless. It's so timeless. Yeah. When they're debating the rights of like giving birth.
Yes.
And he's like, but you're a dude. He's like, no, but I still need the right to have babies. Because maybe I want babies, but they're like, but you're a dude.
Crazy.
It's timeless. It's so good. And it's like, are you the Judean People's Front? And he's like, fuck off. Are you the People's Front of Judea?
Yeah, I remember them.
Yeah, I love it. No, I'm excited to screen that.
Brilliant. That's genius.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
I'm still waiting for the Resurrection of the Passion of the Christ? What's the sequel?
Oh, yeah. He's been talking about that for ages.
Yeah.
He's going to arise with a machine gun.
No, that's the Family Guy joke.
Oh, really?
There's literally a Family Guy joke about Passion of the Christ 2. And it's him with like a Chris Rock
Like a sidekick.
A Chris Tucker character where he's like, damn, Jesus, you're crazy. And they're like shooting their guns and like going well, after
each other. I mean, it makes sense because Trump appointed Gibson, Voight, and Stallone as like his strong muscle men to make Hollywood strong again. Like,
oh, yeah.
So Jesus is going to come up and he's be like, I'm not actually Jewish. I'm Christian, and shoots everyone. Take that, Christ killers. And then explosions and fucking, yeah.
That would be rad.
Yeah.
Lovely. have you got any Hey Did You Guys See, Cole?
No, not necessarily news, but Hey Did You Guys See, talking about the Bible, and those movies tend to be terrible.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Conservative movies that tend to be garbage.
But then there's a trailer for a series, I don't know if it's a miniseries, on Amazon Prime called House of David, about David and Goliath.
Oh, cool.
And... Okay. I watched the trailer. I was like, does this look good? I'm sorry, this looks great. Like, they're all brown people.
Oh, wow.
It's like, okay, cool. That's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
And it's all about like the unsuspecting, I don't know, shepherd's boy that like rises through the ranks of the army to fight Goliath at the end. But they've turned it into an entire story and it looks good. It looks like epic, right? Like, it's shot epic. And,
yeah.
And I just saw the trailer. It looks good. Something in it, dude. So I was like, okay.
You're talking about authenticity.
Yes. Well done. Thank you.
Yeah, Jesus was a brown man, folks.
Yeah.
He was a brown man.
100%. Yeah. With woolen hair. Yeah. I think, do you know what? Like,
big calloused hands.
Yeah, because he's a carpenter. Yeah. The thing is, like you said, you know, these conservative movies tend to be awful, especially faith-based movies. So it's very hard when you find a faith-based movie that is actually fucking good.
Mm.
I mean, Silence is a faith-based movie. It is.
Or Signs.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Silence, Lost Temptation of Christ.
I mean, recently, Conclave.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's a faith moment in that climax where you're just like, oh, the Holy Spirit's with us.
Yeah.
And I was like in it with the drama. I mean, fuck yeah, guys.
He even has that speech about faith. Like, with us, we need doubt for faith to live. And it's such a great moment. So,
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous, gorgeous.
Yeah,
gorgeous.
Last week, I went on a big rant about the movie The Forge.
Oh, yeah?
Because it's on Netflix, in the top 10. It's been in the top 5 for ages, and it's, ugh.
Is it The Gorge?
No, Forge.
Not to be confused with the science fiction fantasy movie from Apple called The Gorge.
Yeah.
This is The Forge, which is...
Where is it?
It's on Netflix. Don't waste your time. It's a very Christian movie, but in a way that's like, it's a bit painful.
Was that terrible trailer that was happening last year about that family, and there's two kids, and then...
No.
Sorry. Okay. No. There was a trailer going around and I was just like, fuck this trailer. It is pathetic.
No, it was just a bit much. But we don't have to get into it.
We don't.
Should we chat movies?
Yeah.
Okay, why not?
Cool. All right.
Oh, wait, one more.
Yeah,
Conan O'Brien is returning as Oscar host next year.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, excited for that, man.
Lovely.
And hopefully they let him do a Billy Crystal film montage.
Yeah, like he wanted
to
fucking do. Yeah. Yeah, Jesus. But yeah, I'm excited for that. Anyways.
Awesome.
Over to you, Russ.
Lovely. I think it's worth chatting a little bit about Snow White.
Mm,
totally.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's for youngsters.
Okay.
It's for kids, primarily women. I mean, young girls. So
I think it's always been the case.
That's always been the case. And it was delightful. It was fine. It was lekker. It was solid.
Yeah, I'm cool. I'm glad to hear that because it was so like its arrival has been like so muddied by like the shit that's what's her name, the lead actress,
Rachel Zegler,
like the shit that she said.
So yeah. So for starters, we don't have to dwell in the controversies, but let's use the controversies as a way to talk about this movie.
Mm.
So one of the first ones was, correct me if I'm wrong, but the fact that she's not a white person.
Yeah.
She's Latina.
Yeah. And we all know Snow White is called Snow White because of the whiteness of her skin.
Yes.
So obviously this caused a little hustle and bustle and controversy out there. But who gives a shit? So this movie explains it and gives a new reason, which is that on the night that she was born, it was a very snowy night. And so she was named after the whiteness of the snow.
See,
on the night
fine.
That she was born.
Yeah.
Totally fine.
Come on.
Because in a lot of European history, there was a lot of Persian and darker folks. And so people don't need to be lily white. And also, who gives a fuck?
The first one, and so I
went back and watched a little bit of the first one. I didn't have enough time to watch the whole thing through, but it was interesting to watch the 1937 Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which is obviously on Disney Plus, and you realize you just get into it straight away.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like this, Bambi as well starts straight away.
Yeah. Just starts straight away with very little context of her upbringing, where she came from, her parents. There's no mention of her parents in the original. Mm. But this one builds a bit more context, which I think is quite nice. And it sets up the idea that her parents were good people that we're trying to raise her right with good values and telling her how she can make a difference in the world. And so it's like they're injecting good values and good morals into her, which I think is interesting. So that's the one thing, is the difference in where the name comes from.
Yes.
I just want to point out at one point how fucking old that first movie is.
Yeah, mm-hmm. 1937. It's only 100 years
old. It is very old. Yeah. And it's like, it just audibly is so old.
Right.
And
the
I
mics
don't
sound old.
Yeah, and we just don't
everything's clipping.
Yeah. So we don't all watch it, do we?
I watched it. Like I watched it like a couple times.
Yeah, I watched old movies,
but recently?
Yeah. No. But like
when we were kids.
Yeah, I watched it when I was kids. I watched it once when I got the DVD when they're releasing all the classic films
on
DVD.
Yeah.
And I watched it then. Okay. Yeah, it's like a lovely piece of filmmaking. Did you know? Hence, you're going to see that the first song in the movie, Someday My Prince Will Come, I didn't know that's become a jazz standard.
Oh,
a couple times I've been out at a jazz evening.
That's crazy.
And they start pulling out Someday My Prince Will Come. And I'm like, oh, fuck. It's a jazz standard.
That was one of the songs that was scrapped in the new one.
That's such a beautiful song.
Because the other thing.
Has to do with.
So there is no prince.
Okay.
He's a normal dude. Okay. He's got a name. In the original, you don't even know what this prince's name is.
Yeah, then he just comes
prince.
And kisses and just, a sleeping woman.
And within the first minute of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, he's just like, oh, I'm a prince and I'm on a horse and I look over the wall and there you are. And now I love you. And she's like, now I love you.
Yeah, it's outdated.
Like, there's no fucking build up. Yeah. There's no courting. There's nothing. It's just like, oh, I'm the prince.
Yeah.
And the prince of what? You fucking know.
It's much old school fairy tale.
Yeah. Right? And so that part just lacks, I think, a lot of meaning and purpose. So in this one, we are introduced to Jonathan. It's his name.
Okay.
And
is it Jonathan Bailey?
That's just his name. His name is
Jonathan.
Pulls
out.
And he's
yeah, I'm not watching.
He's more of a Robin Hood kind of character.
Okay.
So he lives in the woods and they are like a sort of rebel army of some sort.
Ragtag
group of rebels that don't like the queen. And he is the true love's kiss. So it's still traditional in that sense, but he's not this prince. And she still needs him to break the spell at the end, but he's not the prince that she's been waiting for.
Yeah.
She's the prince that she meets, likes, and fucking chooses to be with.
In the original.
That's cool.
So
I like
there's
that.
No fucking harm.
Yes.
There's no one is harmed.
But yeah, the woke liberal left have, of course, ruined our traditional Snow White values.
Yeah. Know? Well, this is the thing is
fucking
that she.
Idiots.
So Rachel Zegler was saying this. Building up to the release, going, you know, she's not waiting for her prince, and it's not about the prince coming to save her. And so
that
stirred the pot a bit.
Yeah,
but she still falls in love. She still needs the guy to break the spell. It's still there.
Okay.
It just with a more of a 360 sort of, you know, he's got a name for the start.
Yes,
they actually spend time together.
Yes, in the original. Did the prince know that there was a spell, or did he just kiss a sleeping woman?
That's where she was. I'm pretty sure he just kissed her because she was like,
she was beautiful and
honest.
Asleep. So it's the necrophilia is
well,
just
I know,
like.
I know that's why. So one of her things was she said that the original is quite problematic. Like
it
she
is.
Wasn't. She wasn't shitting on the film's overall meaning. She was like, there's just problematic instances in it. And then of course all these neckbeards fucking stormed on Facebook and were like, how dare she take away my favorite movie that I only cared about 5 minutes ago.
And also these guys that have never given a shit about Snow White in their entire lives.
Literally, like,
you know? I think the point that is interesting
as well.
About the outrage, I think the point that's interesting is that there will always be some level of rumblings and ugliness. I think what made this movie particularly different is that this seemed overwhelming. The criticisms and the controversy was bigger than the love.
Yeah.
And I think that's where this thing tipped. You know, like Star Wars will always have people going, "Bah, this and this and this." And there'll always be some grumblings and some you know, Reddit threads that are fucking negative.
Yes.
But I think in this case, what made it interesting was that it was overwhelmingly big. And I think that's because the general public don't necessarily care or want or needed this film.
Mm.
It wasn't. We weren't dying to get a remake of a 1937 fairy tale.
Yeah, I think it was balanced by like bad criticisms and good criticisms as well. So like, unfortunately, the bad criticisms outscaled it because Peter Dinklage came out and was like, "What the fuck with the CGI dwarves?"
Yeah,
he was like, "There's actors available to do that. At least give them a chance to prove they can do that." You know what I mean?
Okay.
So he was like upset about that.
Yes.
Because the CGI, when I saw the trailer, I was like, "Jesus, this looks terrible." Just from the dwarves, like it looks bad.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care. Like I personally dig Rachel Zegler. I thought she was outstanding in West Side Story. Mm. I think she's phenomenal. But a lot of the outrage came from literally right wing white conservative dudes mostly.
Yeah.
And they just also these ugly posts that I see popping around where they're like, they of course show the most unflattering picture of Rachel Zegler. And they're like, "Wow, Gal Gadot's really jealous of her beauty." Like, fuck off, you assholes.
No,
like,
it's terrible. Well,
yeah. So then what you also come to realize is it's the inner beauty. And so it's all about being good and being a good person, which is lovely values to install in a young girl or a young person in general. The dwarves were a little difficult to watch. We haven't quite seen that kind of...
like Uncanny Valley
kind of vibes? No, they were actually done really well, but we just haven't seen that kind of level of CGI being done.
Right.
Okay.
Where it's super realistic, like every little sort of...
hair
on their head.
Yeah.
But it's totally fine.
Okay.
The other thing which is interesting is there's more of a context between Snow White and the evil stepmother, which in the original they were very far apart.
Mm.
They actually spent very little time actually interacting, where in this case you can actually see the build up of their relationship and the opposing sort of forces of their beliefs. So there's just more context in that sense. The stepmother dies in a different way. It's a bit more it's a bit more sort of Snow White to her. And then it's also her own undoing. It's interesting. There's a few little differences.
What are the musical numbers like? I heard they're really, really like quite impressive.
No, they're great.
Yeah.
They're good. They're solid, and they still give an ode to a couple of the old ones. Whistle While We Work.
Okay.
Hi ho. They've added to that, but then there's some nice sort of more cheeky ones that are a bit more like they feel a little bit more like Wicked.
Okay.
They're very sort of that modern popular musical sounding songs, because once again that old one is just so old that it just sounds
it
sounds like you're putting on this old little jazz record with these voices sort of far away that are very interesting. But I just thought it would be worth mentioning that how much of a success the first one was, and so it made $8 million during its initial release against its budget of $1.5 million.
Shit.
So $8 million in 1937 is incredible.
Gargantuan, yeah.
So becoming the highest grossing film of 1938, which it then came out, briefly holding the record of the highest grossing sound film of all time. It was also the highest grossing animated film for 55 years.
Jesus.
Don't forget, this is also... its biggest title is the fact that it was the first
animated film.
Feature film.
Yeah.
I'm guessing Lion King probably broke that.
I think it must have been. Yeah. Adjusted for inflation, it's one of the top 10 performers at the North American box office and is still the highest grossing animated film if adjusted for inflation, which is like $2.2 billion.
But do you know what's crazy about when you mention that it's such an old movie? When we were growing up, like with Disney movies, I mean, most of us, I'm assuming, had some sort of Disney tape on something, right? Because we were at that age where we didn't care what we were watching, really, we didn't really know how old things were. I didn't realize Little Mermaid was the fucking 80s. I didn't realize Jungle like Robin Book Hood. Was the 60s. Yeah, yeah Robin dude. Hood's the 50s, isn't
yeah,
it?
It's yeah, it's old.
It's fucking old. And, like, it's crazy how those stories stick with us, regardless of how old they are, because they made such an impression on us as children. Yes. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's moments in those movies that are forever embedded in our fucking brains, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, especially where when they're just in that old princess castle time, which is like, what the fuck was that time? Yeah. Was that the Renaissance? Like, when was that? When were we in fucking castles riding to each other's houses on horses?
I always assumed it was like...
When was that?
Because it's
yeah,
too...
where?
Yeah.
And where? It was yeah, all it's like... Just... It's all like sort of some part of Europe.
But yes. Yeah, it's always like... Because I know a lot of those castles are based on those German castles in Bavaria and stuff like that. Yeah.
And so they wouldn't even be speaking English.
Yeah.
You fuckhead.
Yeah. With American accents. Yeah.
And they wouldn't be they wouldn't be called Eric. Yeah. And Jonathan, they'd be like,
why were people getting angry about this, man? Yeah. You know?
And then also they wouldn't be just choosing who they love, right? Yeah. Their parents would be making alliances and then marriage is a contract. That's
someone really fucked up on that, eh?
Wow. No, but one part of the controversy that doesn't do the film any favors was the fact that you have Gal Gadot, who is Israeli, being
She's
a supporter of Israel, and then you've got Rachel Zegler, who is
pro-Palestine,
although Latina, still, you know, is a supporter of Palestine.
Yeah.
And in the movie, you very much have a strong military force in the Queen, subjugating her brown...
horses
stepdaughter to sort of clean the floors and live a life where she doesn't know how powerful
hectic
filmmakers knew it
just some subtext you know,
or important her role is in society until she finds her voice it's interesting.
And then isn't there a rebellion?
Somewhat,
yeah. And it's framed as like a really positive thing in Hollywood storytelling.
Yeah.
But then when that happens in real life, they're fucking
terrorists. She's not jealous of her look. She's jealous of her land. like that's what's happening, man.
That's the real reason.
Yeah, I know a lot of the press, I don't know if they're doing it to pump up awareness for it to like, you know, bad press is good press kind of thing.
Yes.
I know they've already started saying that apparently they just don't get along, those two, like in real life, because their views are so different from one another. They just don't get along. Like not that they fight. They just know that they're different. They avoid each other. You know
Which
what
is
I mean?
Fine.
They,
you colleagues, fight. You had to work together.
Yeah.
And so then, just to close it off, instead of big premieres and having these stars walk red carpets around the world, they chose to minimize that.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to subjugate the cast to these kinds of
bullying
negative
and stuff,
questions.
Yeah.
And so, it just became one of those films that just unfortunately got lost in its own hurricane.
Yeah.
Sometimes the hurricane works. You know, sometimes it just breaks through.
Mm.
And that's all you can wish for with a piece of creative art, especially a film.
Mm.
That there is so much being released. If you just get some heat on your stove.
Yeah.
To get some bubbles in your pot. Like you are lucky. No, because
they love Russell's metaphors, sorry.
Because you just simply can't break through. And I think that's maybe something to talk about now, perhaps as we move on to Black Bag.
Okay.
If there's anything else to mention on Snow White, mention it. But you know, Black Bag was just one of those smaller spy thrillers that was going to get lost. And so it's quite nice to see it getting some praise. But we'll start talking about that in a bit.
Can you guys give me a back of the box in Black Bag? I feel like
Are you ready to move on? I'm happy to move on. Okay. So I got the chance to watch Black Bag quite a while ago at an exhibitor screening. And I really must say, I really want to try and temporarily employ you guys to work at the Bioscope so that you can come and join me. Because what you miss in these exhibitor screenings is the chance to hear the gasps, the laughs, the you know, the reactions which you get at the media screenings that we have traditionally gone to. But what's nice about the exhibitor screenings is that they're quite far in advance, which is what I find very helpful.
Okay.
So I walked out of that going, Jesus, that was a bit smart, but like maybe a bit too smart.
Yeah.
Oh.
But that's not a bad thing.
No.
And so what it is, it's a spy thriller where you've got Kate Blanchett and Michael Fassbender, who are husband and wife that both work in British intelligence.
Okay.
Okay, so they're part of that sort of MI6 world. There's a nice, sexy headquarters. Pierce Brosnan's their sort of boss.
Some nice meta narrative there.
And so there is that sort of heightened level of kind of cool, slick, James Bondian kind of spyness to it, but it doesn't have the pomp and over-the-topness of it. It feels like it's rooted quite
in reality.
And it's all about the sort of this situation that Michael Fassbender finds himself in, where he has to actually be monitoring his wife. But he knows, he trusts her, but he realizes he doesn't know certain things, and she's kept certain things from him.
Okay.
I'm not giving much away, but the term black bag is when him as the husband says, "Where are you going? Like, what is this trip that you have to do?" And she says, "Black bag," as in like,
don't go there.
You can't know.
Okay.
So they've got secrets that they keep from each other, but it's it is rooted in a lot of realism, in the sense that you actually walk out of this movie going, "I didn't actually see much action." It's an action movie without the action.
Yeah,
it's all
like
very
that.
Cerebral. Like they're these really great, well-crafted scenes at a dinner party, where someone in the group is the spy, was the mole.
Okay.
And Fassbender sort of invites them all for dinner. That's the sort of opening sort of sequence, is them hosting this dinner party where someone in their sort of intelligence group, is a problem.
Okay.
It's interesting. And of course, Soderbergh doesn't have a standard sort of look and feel and style as a filmmaker.
Is he the DOP on this one again?
I think he might be, because this one's got a very interesting look. I think filmmakers could appreciate it. It's almost got this like glowy, misty,
milky.
I wouldn't say milky.
It's like a bleach bypass, like Spielberg's early noughties Minority Report, Munich, anything like that.
No. It's not so much that. It almost looks like, in The Hobbit, when they were like, we're in ultra HD, but it looked like video.
Fuck, I hated that.
It's got almost that kind of look where there's...
It's too clean.
But he's doubled down and put lots of candles on this dinner table, and they all glow in this particular way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean,
can we give the listeners context as to who Steven Soderbergh is, Per?
Yes. So, yeah, let's go into that.
So, Soderbergh is like one of the, if you look at the great like self-taught filmmakers from the early 90s onwards, you look at Soderbergh, Paul Thomas Anderson, Quentin Tarantino, obviously, and David O. Russell. They were the self-taught guys who taught everything by themselves. They made it that way, right?
Okay.
So Steven Soderbergh did, his breakthrough was Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which he won the Palme d'Or for in the late 80s. And he's basically an indie darling. He's one of those guys who would make like 2 to 3 films a year, each one of them vastly different. He was one of the first guys to be shooting on iPhones and editing whole films off of an iPhone.
Yes.
He did another film this year called Presence, where the whole movie is through the POV of a ghost.
Sure.
Interesting idea.
Yeah.
Not great story, unfortunately. But Soderbergh, I mean, he did Traffic. He did Aaron Brockovich. He did
The Oceans films.
He's of those self-taught filmmakers, I regard him and Paul Thomas Anderson as the filmmakers with a large range that they've worked with. They've evolved, they've adapted, they've evolved again. You look at Paul Thomas Anderson's first films and you look at his latest films, completely different.
Right.
Tarantino kind of sticks the same line.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Same as David O. Russell. Soderbergh as well. You watch Sex, Lies, and Videotape, completely different to fucking Unsane. You know what I mean?
He's the complete opposite of a Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
Instead of building this little box for himself, he's like, I'm going to be completely different each time. But I find it interesting that you use the term self-taught, because the irony is that you can go to film school, but like you don't learn.
Yeah.
You know, you learn some theory at film school and perhaps you get a good chance to build your army of people that you can go out into the world with. But very famously, people have said, take all that money that you were going to spend on film school and travel the world.
Yeah.
Learn how to use a camera. That's easy.
Yeah.
It's the same as photography.
Mm.
Know what the fucking f-stop is and to balance the perfect picture with shutter speed. That can take you 10 minutes.
Yeah.
The next part is get to the fucking sunrise so that you can take a photo of the sunrise.
Yeah.
Yes.
Jump into the mosh pit to take a photo.
Yes.
You can't theorize it from your bedroom.
Yes.
So it's like you got to go out and do.
Yeah.
So were these people... Because Tarantino famously worked at the video store.
Yeah.
But was that a big part of it that they didn't actually go to a film school?
So what I was going to get into, so Paul Thomas Anderson famously went to, I think it was New York Film School. It was one of the big film schools. He went there for like 3 days. He went there. First assignment was the guy was like, cool, I want you to write a scene, like a isolated moment. Just write a scene, right? So he wanted to test the waters. So PTA went home and he was like, okay, there's a great scene in the film called Hoffa. Hoffa was Danny DeVito, Jack Nicholson. It was about Jimmy Hoffa. Danny DeVito directed that. Anyways, there's a scene in that movie where a guy's driving in a car and he lights a cigarette and he keeps it between his fingers on the steering wheel, but he's falling asleep. Every time it landed and burnt him, it would wake him up and he'd relight the cigarette.
Okay.
So like... It's a well-written scene. It's well-written in purpose, you know, description, everything. And he brought that to the class, and the lecturer read that. He was like, this is a dog shit scene. What the fuck is this? It's terrible. It's blah. And PTA was like, cool, I'm out.
I'm out of here.
I'm out of here. He took the money that he got his refund back for like admission and all that.
Yeah.
He told his dad, he's like, can I actually just make a short film? He was like, fine, do it. And that's how PTA got his start, is he made a short film with that money and he learned from that. And you look at guys like Sean Baker as well. I think Sean Baker is because he's in the spotlight right now, great example of a filmmaker who does things with limited resources. I mean, Tangerine, which is about these trans prostitutes on Christmas Eve in LA, it's like a one-day event. It's such a great movie. Shot in an iPhone 5. So, like, you can do this stuff.
I think it's less, perhaps the term is less self-taught and more just, like, just great indie ingenuity.
Yeah, yes. And I mean, but that's what it is as well. I mean, like, I know, I hate Harmony Korine, but, like, he's got a good point where, like, these are filmmakers who are encouraging you that, like, the Romanian filmmaker Radu Jude, he thinks that social media and stuff like that now, like even YouTubers and stuff, they're technically filmmakers because they're capturing the zeitgeist in the now. They're capturing the moment.
Absolutely.
And they're using it to tell stories, regardless if those stories are bad or annoying or fucking skibbity toilet or all that shit.
The whole of TikTok is based on jump cuts early film techniques.
But that's filmmaking. We learn to adapt. I mean, there's a great documentary called Room 666, right? So Wim Wenders directed that. It takes place in one single hotel room in Cannes in 1982, I think. And basically this documentary is the camera's sitting static and he interviews like 20 filmmakers of that time. So you see like big players. You see Spielberg when he was young. You see all these guys. And he allows them to record and talk to the camera how they want. And the one question the whole documentary is filmmaking dying? Is the art of filmmaking dying? And it's interesting to see how people in that time thought it's dead, we're fucked, like TV
so lovely.
It's interesting because they talk about how TV's ruining filmmaking. They're like, people have easier access to making movies now. It's not good for us.
And when was this?
1982. And then there's room.
Because that's such a prevalent question now.
Room 999 came out last year, and it's not by Wim Wenders, but he's in it. Wim Wenders did Paris, Texas, Wings of Desire, great filmmaker. Yeah, yeah. Room 999, same question. So it's interesting to see those filmmakers now are like, oh, social media's, we're dead. It's streaming. TV was the scary ogre back then. Streaming is a scary ogre now. And it's interesting to see filmmakers you respect going, oh, we're fucked. We're done. We're doomed. But then you see filmmakers you love as well. They're like, no, we're good. This is just another step in the evolution of filmmaking.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I know we diverted, but it's important to know this stuff.
Right? I love it. No, I love hearing you bring out this stuff. There was another great nugget in this whole sort of film school and self-taughtness, which was Mario Puzo had to adapt his novel into a screenplay to make The Godfather.
Mm.
and very much questioned his own ability in making a screenplay. And when he was commissioned to do more, he thought, "Fuck, I better go to film school."
Yeah, it was a studio deal.
He felt like he was less than. And apparently, in the class, they were like, "Cool, your first assignment is read The Godfather."
No way!
He's like, okay. So funny,
hilarious.
Yeah.
All right, I think let's move on to TV.
Sure.
Okay, but yeah, Black Bag is in cinemas, just to round that off, including the Bioscope. Very smart.
Okay.
All you got to pay attention, but it's nice. It's an hour and a half. It's not an epic-y.
Can I talk about one film very quickly?
Yeah, go for it.
I know you were excited to watch it. I watched Grand Theft Hamlet.
Oh, fuck.
And it's Hamlet done in Grand Theft Auto 5.
What?
Yeah, so,
I don't know anything about this.
So it's a documentary, and it's about a group of... So the film follows two actors during COVID who did not have work. All the theaters were shut down and stuff, and they were playing GTA 5 online. And then they found a theater spot in Los Santos in the game. They're like... This is pretty cool. And then they start playing around with like Shakespeare. And they're like, why don't we put on a fucking play in the video game? So then they start holding auditions for other players to come. And they would have to get other players to come and protect them because other asshole players would come and just shoot them.
And kill them.
So the documentary is interesting because also one of the actors, his wife is a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker. So she obviously saw that as an opportunity. She's like, this is a fucking cool thing. And I mean, there's, you know, the joke of like, oh, we waited this and we still haven't gotten GTA 6. We've got Shakespeare and GTA 5 and we still haven't
gotten GTA 6. That's amazing. I don't know much about
Mubi.
I don't know much about gaming. So this is a world that exists that you log into and you can run around and do what you want.
That was the big...
And you fuck around and play with other people. Yeah. Right?
I don't know if you could do that in Grand Theft Auto 4. It was 5 that it really
became
a moment.
That's where you go online,
So, like, the story is always, like, there's a city that they build. And every single game, the city just gets better. It gets more sophisticated, more believable. And you have... it's a open world game where you can go anywhere you want. You can follow the storyline if you want, but also you can go hijack cars and murder pedestrians, and you can go try to do backflips off the Golden Gate Bridge or...
Yeah, it's
a sandbox game, right? Mm. So then every game it gets bigger and bigger. The stories are really fucking good.
Yeah.
Like, the stories are cool. Rated it's always Redemption, to do with the underworld of society.
Yeah.
And you're just like a goon, doing jobs.
GTA always... Because GTA and Red Dead Redemption are the same...
Studio.
Yeah.
Red Dead was always more serious, like more
cowboys.
Dramatic. Mm, fucking amazing.
I watched
amazing.
You play that in
Red
COVID.
Dead is so good. Oh my God. And then GTA has always been more tongue in cheek, more self aware, funnier. So Grand Theft Hamlet is interesting. I mean, there are moments where you can tell they're actors, are fabricating a moment, maybe.
Sure.
Like that didn't really happen. There's a scene where they confront each other, and I could hear, I'm like,
this is a bit acting, because
the whole movie is only the footage of the video game, so it's not, you don't cut away to talking heads. It's them walking around and figuring shit out, and it's really another interesting idea of innovative storytelling, where people take something that exists and they're like, oh, no one's done this before, let's try this, what I mean? And it's a really fun watch, and it's cool, and it's heartwarming. It's on Mubi. I don't know if it's on Mubi locally, but it's on Mubi.
So that's Mubi, which is the thinking man's Netflix.
Yeah.
The cinephile's Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool. I love that.
Yeah,
I love hearing about
check
that.
It out.
Cool, let's go on to TV.
Cool.
I think one thing that's worth a mention is we got invited as the video store to attend the launch of David Blaine Do Not Attempt, which is quite a cool, interesting concept. This is a National Geographic show that is going to come to Disney Plus from the 24th of March. So real soon, good old David Blaine in all his magical, weird, gross body horror glory.
Yeah. Is
looking at all the sort of magic around the world and the craziness of it all. And episodes are shot in South Africa, which is very cool.
Oh, rad.
So, a lot of what he does isn't just simple magic. A lot of it is like pushing the physical body.
Mm.
David Blaine's one of those people that have scientifically figured out how he could like put a stake through his hand. You know, it looks like magic, but he's actually just figured out, you know, if it goes through there, it doesn't hit any nerves and whatever, whatever. So he's pushed his body.
Fucking weirdo.
So, yeah. You know, so there is a scene, for example, in Joburg where they go and watch Spinners, which is, you know, the classic Fast and the Furious kind of Joburg thing, which we see. And, you know, it is a remarkably unique South African thing to be in those cars and spinning.
Yeah.
But, you know, he sees it as it's, as a kind of a form of magic, and the fact that these people have very expertly been able to put their lives at risk to do these shows. They do a show very similar to how he does this kind of magic show that puts his body at risk. He finds a dude just in Durban who sits in a room with black mambas. You know, snake sitting exists as a thing, but this guy is, it's so funny. He's this old belly, and he's like, "Ah, people have got the wrong idea about mambas, you know."
Do they?
And then it's like, and then you're like, why is he in crutches? What happened to the bottom left of his left leg? Yeah. And then it's, and he's like, no, they're fine. They're not going to bite you, but don't fucking move. And of course, like, you can see David Blaine like genuinely fucking scared, like genuinely scared to sit in this room.
Hey,
I like that. It's cool. You see those like mythic figures actually appear human.
Yes.
You
know
what I mean? Yeah. And you realize like the stakes. And what is cool is sort of one of the local people that are kind of showing him around and almost a little bit of a co-host is Muzi, the musician, who we've had come and visit us here at the video store. We've got a lovely episode with him in the back catalogs. So through Muzi and Muzi's really cool manager, John, I met the crew when they came out.
Oh, cool.
And it was cool to know that this show was going to happen. And that's then it was cool. And that was months ago. And so it was really cool to then be invited to the launch, see this kind of final product, and it's going to be good television.
When does it drop?
Soon, 24th of March.
Oh, sick.
On Disney Plus.
Oh, wow. And of course, tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, it's cool. I like that. And they also were talking about the head of Disney in South Africa was showing us all the upcoming shows and what also some of the new releases, and included in that is the No Taste Like Home, which I just fucking love.
Oh yeah, you recommended that to you. Yeah.
I recommended it to you. Anthony from Queer Eye.
Yeah, yummy Anthony. Yeah.
That's still is worth another mention, which is on Disney Plus, which is this kind of finding your roots.
I love those kinds of
lineage,
shows,
but through food. It's so touching. Awesome. Such a great show. Such an easy watch. But yeah, I want to just give one more shout out to the fact that I brought up adolescence last week.
Oh yeah.
And spoke about it. And in the last week, it's been incredible to see how much attention it's since gotten.
Yeah.
Where the world is like, oh my God, this is an incredible piece of storytelling. What I didn't know, which I came to realize when watching some of this stuff the last week, is that the main dude, the dad, he created it. He wrote it.
Stephen Graham.
Yeah.
From This Is England. That guy.
He's the main, father in Adolescence.
Yeah, Stephen Graham. He's
from, like, he was in Snatch.
Yeah, yeah. He's Tommy.
Are you waiting for the Germans?
Yeah, yeah.
No, so he's the dad.
Yeah, he's fucking phenomenal.
Quick, have you seen this? Do you know what we're talking about?
I know what you're talking about.
Okay,
I've seen
it. Quick back of the box. It's a four-part series with the most spectacular concept, which is the fact that every episode is one interrupted, uncut, single take.
Yeah.
Now, you hear this in other films like 1917 and a few others, but they used very careful blocking and editing to hide that. This is not that. This is very clearly
one take.
And it was rehearsed like a play, performed like a play. And it tells the story of a young boy who murders a young girl. And the next morning, he's picked up. The first episode is literally the raid on the house as they get this boy and take him to the police station.
Fuck.
It's actually not a whodunit, because you come to realize this. And a part of me still, while watching it the first time, thought, is this a whodunit? But later, when you hear him talking in interviews, he's like, no, we come to know he did it. That part wasn't a mystery. They still leave it somewhat ambiguous, but he's like, that part's not a mystery. The point of the show is how did we get there? And he said that what inspired him was reading the fact that these kinds of murders have taken place, and they took place in different parts of the country, in the UK, sure. And it was happening. And so that's what inspired him to write this crazy story of how does something like this happen?
Wow. It's interesting because, Stephen Graham did you ever watch Boiling Point?
That was like the sort of Wall Street stuff.
No. So what Stephen Graham, he plays a chef on one crazy night at his restaurant, and it's also a winner.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and that came out like 2 years ago. So it's interesting.
So he obviously knows that technique.
Yeah.
And it's not a difficult thing to watch because we live our lives real time.
Yes.
So it's not difficult as the human to watch that. It's not a stretch. Yeah.
Mm.
And someone like Les, who was watching, this is my wife, was watching in a bit second screen.
Okay.
Which I think a lot of Netflix viewers do watch. And every time you look down and look up again, it might in your brain feel like it's cutting.
There's been a cut.
She was like, no, it cut to the boy. I was like, no, it didn't. I was watching it. I wasn't on my phone. Yeah. I knew this concept. But you'd find this interesting to hear. I didn't bring it up. And only after the second episode, I said, have you noticed the filmmaking technique that makes this fundamentally different to anything else we've watched? And she's like, what are you talking about?
Oh, hectic, yeah.
And then I revealed it to her, and she's like, cool.
Yeah, it feels like it's this year's Baby Reindeer, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of
no, it's definitely
a runaway hit for something that's smaller, you know, and British.
But the acting is undeniably incredible.
Stephen Graham is fucking incredible.
And Stephen Graham's always been great.
And it just
so
shows
good.
You the actor. This is what I said last week, is that a theater is the actor's medium because it's just you. You're up there and it's just you. You know, there's no cutting and fancy direction or CGI. It's just you.
Mm.
And so you can really see the talent of someone if you watch them in a play.
Absolutely.
And so you are now watching these actors basically perform a play that's televised.
Mm. Yeah.
And so you really get to see their chops. And the boy in question, who's on the embroiled in all of this, he was not a theater actor. He wasn't an actor. He was a first timer.
Yeah, indeed.
So that really makes it special.
Yeah.
But I don't want to talk more because we spoke about it last week. So you can chat. You can hear it then. But Adolescence on Netflix.
I really want to
really,
check it out.
Really, really, really worth your time. There's a part of it near the end that gets a little bit hardcore to watch.
Right.
Like it's quite emotionally taxing, but very much worth it.
Mm.
Okay. Speaking of smart, cerebral shows, Severance.
Yeah.
How's it for you?
So I just finished this weekend. Best show on TV.
Really? Yeah.
Really?
For me, best show on TV right now. It's fucking phenomenal. Like,
what is good about it?
It's just so smart. It's so fucking well written. It's so well directed. It's just, it's got that level of mystery that I love in a TV show, you know, where like it just takes your life up. You know what I mean? Where you're
sure.
like, what the fuck could this mean? What the fuck could that mean? You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
We haven't come any closer to understanding the bigger puzzle.
There are some reveals this season.
What
where,
Lumen is.
Yeah, like what the numbers mean, like that they're playing with on the computer. So the thing is, like, after the season, I was like, I can't picture it going for another two seasons. I think season three needs to be the last.
They have to have worked out. Well, they have to have.
So, yeah, Ben Stiller has said that he knows how it ends. They've already discussed it because. The problem with those kinds of shows, you don't want to build a mystery that runs away from you.
No, of course. It's like
Lost had that problem.
Yeah.
So Lost, Damon.
Debatable.
No, I loved Lost.
Okay.
I fucking loved Lost. Rewatching it as well. People who don't understand ending. Are you fucking
stupid, dude.
Kidding me?
But you can't milk the teat. Because the more you milk it, the more you're like, oh my God.
Running out of milk.
So in reference to Lost, so Damon Lindelof, who created that, he's a fucking genius. He did The Leftovers, which is my all-time favorite show. And he did Watchmen, which is incredible. And he did Mrs. Davis, which is hysterical, and you need to watch it.
Okay.
He's doing Green Lantern right now. Anyways, so when he did Lost, he learned his lesson from that, where they wanted that show to be like three seasons. But because it was so massive ABC was like, no, let's fucking milk this.
Right.
So they often, he learned his mistake that they built mysteries and that got away from them. That's why by the end of it, there are some mysteries that aren't answered and stuff. But with The Leftovers, one of my favorite parts about that show is the theme song from seasons 2 and 3 is she literally sings, I suppose I'll just let the mystery be. And that's great.
Okay.
Sometimes you don't need all the answers.
You don't.
You know what I mean? You need the answers to things that you are fucking highlighting heavily.
Yes.
Like, this is the core mystery of the whole thing. This is what we do. Severance, I feel like, isn't doing that, which is great. And
Lindelof involved?
No. So that's what I'm just saying is that Lindelof is a guy where he learned from his mistake, and his shows that have followed since have been short seasons, short runs.
Severance is learning from his lessons.
Yeah, I think so. And just Severance is just so fucking smart. It's such a good observation of our fucking lives in corporate industries, in any kind of work, we want to separate our work lives from our home lives, right?
Yeah.
And it's just so fucking smart. I mean, this last episode is just event after event after event. It's just the most tense fucking finale I've seen in a long time.
Okay, so we're at the end of season 2 now. It's come just out. Ended. It's just ended. Yeah. Season 2. Okay. So
there's this final frame that you guys would fucking froth over. Oh my God.
Because the first season also ended on this incredible cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And this is over on Apple TV Plus. And it ended in such a way that you were very excited.
Yeah, careful, but he hasn't finished.
But then season 2 took a long time to come out.
Yeah, 3 years.
And so the advice, because I started season 2 going, wait, what? What's this again? And who's what? The innies and the arties. And so you actually realize you got to watch season 1 again.
Yeah,
that's
what I'm doing. Yeah.
So that's what folks are doing. But yeah, the basic back of the box is you've got this point in society where you can sever your work life from your
home life. Yeah.
And our main character, as he sort of travels down the lift into his sort of almost sort of basement office, becomes a different person, and he's got his life there with the people and the things that they're doing, and that's all he knows there.
When he gets
upstairs, he doesn't know what he's doing, and of course there's now a mystery as to what they're doing down there. Do they know? And how do you communicate between this kind of these severed parts of your life?
Yeah, it's a really like dense philosophical idea because it's the whole when you start to contemplate what the innies are as they do in the show, is that they are essentially lab rats. They only exist at work life. So that's their whole life is, and there's a great moment in season 1. I don't know if I'm Mandela affecting me myself, but like they suddenly just feel refreshed. Where they're like, oh, there's a moment where you'll just suddenly feel refreshed because your auntie has slept and refreshed himself, so that you'll be walking around and suddenly you're refreshed. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So yeah, it's just a phenomenal show. Adam Scott, give him the fucking Emmy. Holy shit! It blows my mind that Ben Stiller. I mean, it's not like Ben Stiller was a bad filmmaker in the first place, but he never really did anything that was like this fucking dense and smart and like tough. You know what I mean?
It's not the same thing as Secret Life of Walter Mitty, right?
Yeah, 100%.
It's on another level.
But even Tropic Thunder has aged really well because it's like it's such a good critique on like outrage culture and, you know, like when people were trying to cancel Tropic Thunder because of the Robert Downey Jr. performance, but everyone who tried to cancel it didn't actually watch it and realize that that was a critique of that.
Yeah, you know what I mean? No, of course.
So like when I remember there was one guy who was like, oh, fuck this movie. I can't believe we haven't canceled Robert Downey Jr. What the fuck? And he watched the movie and he actually rescinded his comments because he was like, oh, I actually... That was the point.
Yeah.
That film never deserved anything. And it didn't actually really get it. It's been praised more than criticized.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit like what we were debating earlier.
You got an
earlier.
Oscar nomination for that.
No, of course. It's wild. But it's just one of those things. There will always be that criticism. But where is it in the balances?
Yes.
It was far, far outweighed by people going, this is funny. I get it.
Yeah.
It's smart.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and it's when that topples that it becomes an issue, which this clearly was the case with Snow White.
Yes.
But anyway, Severance is amazing. Go watch it.
Apple TV Plus.
Yeah.
Last thing to chat about, White Lotus.
Okay, so White Lotus, I'm not up to date with episode 5 yet, and 6 as this comes out. But I'm loving it. It's so good. It's, I mean, what's the name of the guy who created the show? White. Mark White.
Mark White, yeah.
He's so, Ned, so good. He's Ned Schneebly School of Rock.
School of Rock. And he was on two seasons of Survivor, I think.
And he's cast a lot of the Survivor people in the shows.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
They'll be like background extras or something. So, like I'm a big Survivor watcher. So, like, I'll be like, oh, there's so-and-so, you know. But, yeah, great show. It's just such good fucking writing. It's funny. It's like, oh, it's so good. There's so much drama. Not like drama. Like drama. You know what I mean? Like
it's always a crisis.
Yeah, drama.
Season
exactly.
1 and 2 is like incessant crisis
it's
the whole
so
time.
It's so good. Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite lines ever is the gays are trying to kill me.
These gays are trying to kill me.
Who do I look like? Peppa Pig. So funny.
There's a... I haven't seen it yet, but I know that...
Oh, you haven't started?
No. Yeah,
the new season, yeah. Okay.
There's a Hang Dong moment.
Oh, yeah. It's Oscar Isaac.
It's Patrick Schwarzenegger, isn't it?
No. It's Isaac. Did you watch the OA?
No.
Fuck.
No, but you are going to see Patrick Schwarzenegger's dick in this movie.
I haven't seen it yet, but have you seen the character who plays his dad's dong? Okay. And we need to do a dong episode. Cole.
Oh, yeah. We still have to do our Hang Dong episode.
But it's fucking great TV. It's just funny. It's interesting. Characters are great.
And it's still a whodunit, right?
Yeah, like they're always the...
What's
the,
a who died?
Yeah, the
you
hook,
know there's going to be a die.
Yeah,
a
the hook always, every season starts with a random body shows up, but we don't see who it is, and then it kicks into gear.
Okay, and this is the same.
This one's got the most like extreme start I've seen. So okay. Like,
excellent.
There's like machine gun fire at the beginning.
Oh my God. Yeah.
It's okay. Fucking crazy. So, like, okay. I'm loving it.
I've also loved hearing the fact that we're... So, obviously, each season is at a different hotel.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is another White Lotus hotel.
Yeah.
And they're across the world. And apparently, these hotels are just getting the most incredible bookings. Obviously, the even though these atrocities maybe happen in the fictional version of it, people have... obviously been watching these incredible, beautiful hotels.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they find out where they actually were shot and bookings are skyrocketing around the world.
Genius.
Yeah, it's always the class dynamic in each season. So they'll always follow these rich, privileged people.
Yeah.
And then people who are like kind of in the middle where they're just there by chance. And then the people who are working for them.
Yeah.
And to the quote unquote, the lower class according to them, right? And yeah, I mean, it's also every season's got such a good cast. I mean, Walton Goggins is amazing. I always forget Walton Goggins isn't a Southern. He doesn't have a Southern accent normally.
Oh, doesn't he?
He's just a normal dude. It's
he's
like,
always cast as that guy.
Yeah, exactly. And he's so good in this. He's just like. I also love the mystery of White Lotus. There's all these characters you just slowly unpack and unwind every episode.
Yeah, it's like it's all about predicting how they're going to collide because
exactly.
You know that there's a collision coming.
And you start going, oh, this person so-and-so is going to die. Oh, yeah, but like it's just it's the theme song's changed. I actually prefer the theme song to the
I
other
know.
Ones.
The first two are iconic.
Yeah,
the first
I think this one slaps. But
okay. People aren't happy about it because it's a banger.
It. Yeah.
Let's talk about Wheel of Time.
So Wheel of Time fantasy series on Amazon Prime. You should remember me talking about it before. It's based on the Wheel of Time books by Robert Jordan.
Yeah.
And there's like 13 of them. They're each 1,000 pages long. It's like if you're a fantasy reader, it's always a thing that you get into Wheel of Time and you do it.
It's going to come for you eventually.
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to take you a boost long time to get through all those books. But now they're adapting them. And they're 13 books. We're on season 3. I think each season is a book, if I'm not mistaken. But it's basically a Chosen One story set in this magical universe that has its own kind of rules around magic.
A Chosen what universe?
A Chosen One story.
Okay.
So like there's a person who is the Chosen One, the prophesized person.
Oh, okay.
You know, which I always kind of roll my eyes at, but it's actually like done pretty well. It's really cool. The idea is that men cannot wield magic in this world because if they wield what's called the darkness or the light, they become corrupt and they go insane. It like destroys their mind completely. But women...
Okay.
Can use it. So there's this council of women and they each like have a color and each of those colors represents a different facet of using that magic. So for example, there are the reds and their entire job is to hunt down men that wield magic so they can, I can't remember what it's called, but they like sever their connection to magic. So they can't use it anymore. We can't have any.
So each season you think is a book?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, and there's 13 of these books.
Yeah. So okay, so I imagine there must be some kind of condensing going on.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
in the adaptation.
It has to be, yeah.
Okay, but when were the books written, do you know?
I think it's like early 90s. I know that there's an author called Brandon Sanderson who wrote a really cool series of books called The Mistborn Trilogy and The Stormlight Archives. And he's like this really popular fantasy author. And when Robert Jordan died,
he took over
and wrote his final three books based on his notes.
Okay.
I think it was three. I can't remember exactly.
Okay, so there is a finite amount and it's not like there could even be more.
No, exactly. Yeah. But
okay, Wheel of Time.
Yeah, it's also one of these series in the new like kind of Rings of Power era where we have like a lot of people of color in fantasy that we haven't had before. It's like predominantly women instead of men in fantasy.
But it sounds like the story pushes for that, for that to be
it's
the
like
case.
It's this world that's like 10,000 years after technology. It's like a
like
post-apocalyptic
Dune,
world, actually. Okay. It's very much like Dune, yeah.
Okay. Isn't it Rosamund Pike?
Yeah.
Oh, I love her.
And I think that Rosamund Pike, I'm going to make this claim. I don't know if I'm right, but I think she's the best eye actor in the world.
Oh, interesting.
So like if she couldn't move the rest of her face, she could carry a performance with just her
eyes.
It's
like James Gandolfini in The Sopranos. Fucking
is he
incredible
also an
eye
actor?
Yeah, he was such a great eye actor.
Dude, like the amounts of emotion
Ryan Gosling,
in those
Ryan Gosling, great eye actor.
He is a good eye actor. Yeah. Yes.
It's interesting. I never thought of that as a term.
Yeah. No, you just watch her eyes and you're always just like...
Is that what you wish for?
What? God. Show some dung, Ryan Gosling, of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's probably going to be a prosthetic. But
Oh, come on. That's fine. We'll take it. It'll make our list. We just want to make our list. That's all. That's all we want to do.
Oh, my God. All right. Magic, guys. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kolsky. It was lovely to see you again. And in your great Timothy Chalamet shirt.
Best shirt in the world.
Best shirt in the world.
So good.
And thank you, P-Dog.
Pleasure.
It's nice
thank
to have you,
you
back.
Thanks
it's nice
for having
to,
me here, guys.
It's nice to have you unpack your brain.
Yeah.
It feels like it's a very dense cupboard.
Yeah, sorry.
With lots of...
Sorry if I
with
got crumbs
of,
on your shirt there.
With lots of information. No, yeah. I love it when you sort of open the cupboard and we can just see how many films there are inside.
Yeah, exactly.
thank you, everyone. Thank you for wondering in. Thank you for listening while we have ourselves our chat behind the counter. And we'll see you again next week. We're going to be open for business again next week. And you can wander in and enjoy the video store.
Hell yeah.
Hey, bye.
All right. The home base is the video store. That's here today. And you can see everything there. All right. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye. Cheers.